But the context of this passage is the Apostle Paul is in prison and he's writing a letter to the Philippians. The formal charge, commentator Stephen Fowle notes, against Paul is the phrase mestos, which in Roman law is stated as diminishing the majesty of the emperor and the people of Rome. It is impugning the emperor's status. This is the formal charge against Paul, which is a strange one for a missionary talking about a guy who died on a cross. But of course, that's what the gospel does. It calls into question the emperor and the empire. That the famous phrase of the first century was, Jesus is Lord and Caesar is not. It says that capitalism and communism, that liberalism and conservatism are not the superpowers that all the news outlets want to claim them to be. That there is one who places under his feet and at his authority princes and kings, supreme leaders and presidents. His name is Jesus. And in fact, one of the evidences that the gospel is at work in someone's life is the diminishing esteem they have for the powers of the world, that there becomes this in their heart impugning of the reputation of the emperor. So Paul sits in chains. And we noted last week that as he sits there in a Roman prison, there is this unique feature that is marked by his letter, and it is joy. The joy is this strange effect that, I don't know, I mean, I haven't read a lot of prison letters, I'll be honest with you. But my thought is, if you're writing a letter from prison, you know, it's not going to be characterized by joy. Not a happy place to be. But not for the Apostle Paul. Here he is in chains, and the key feature of this letter that you will see again and again as we walk through this is the presence of joy. And we said last week there were two reasons for this. The first was koinonia, that he notes that his joy is fueled by this deep bond that he has with the Philippian Christians. That even though he sits in prison, there is a sense of pleasure and happiness and joy in his life because he has a partnership in the gospel with these people from far away. We also said last week that there was another reason for his joy, and that's the one I want to talk about this morning. Look with me for a second at verse 12. Paul says this, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. He goes on, verse 13, he says this, my imprisonment is for Christ. Now, I think it's sort of strange what he's doing here, that there's some sense in which he's justifying why he's in prison. And there may be a few reasons for that. It may be that people thought, maybe Paul wanted to clear his name, that he wasn't there for embezzlement or robbery. But the Philippian Christians would have known that. They had people going back and forth. They would have known the formal charges that Paul was in prison for preaching the gospel. Why then does he feel the need to have to tell them that he is here for, and while he is there, it's for Christ and it has served to advance the gospel? Look at verse 15. Paul gives us the explanation of this. He says, some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill, the latter doing it out of love, knowing I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaiming Christ out of selfish ambition. What he's saying here is there seems to be this rival faction of leaders who don't like Paul and they don't like the gospel that he preaches, the one of a man crucified on a cross. And so what they're doing is they're using this opportunity of Paul's imprisonment to squash him. And that would be a very easy thing to do. This time period, and kind of much like ours, I mean, prison is a shameful thing. Somebody who goes to jail is not looked on as a success. And so what Paul's rivals were likely doing is saying to the church in Philippi, look, you heard this gospel that Paul preached of Jesus Christ. What sort of God is that? I mean, he's the front man for this religion, and now he's in chains. If his God is so good, why is his life so horrible? You've heard this thinking before. It's called the prosperity gospel. The idea of the prosperity gospel is that the goodness of my God or my religion is directly tied to the prosperity of my personal circumstances. The idea is, if I practice religion well, God will be happy with me. Everything will go great in my life. I'll be rich. It's what we call the prosperity gospel. And it's very much at work in this passage right now. And of course, the idea today, it's alive and well. I was in Brooklyn a couple years ago at my brother's church. EPC Church, he's an elder there, and buildings are really hard to come by. So we walk in this building, which is not a church, just has a space that they rent. And we're in church, and before it starts, there's all this kind of screaming and yelling and stomping upstairs. I'm like, Peter, what's going on upstairs? He says, oh yeah, that's Creflo Dollar's church. Now, if you don't know who Creflo Dollar is, all you have to do is listen to his name. It pretty much gives it away. I mean, Creflo's all about them dollar bills. That's what Creflo's about. Creflo's a very famous prosperity gospel preacher, and Creflo has a church that meets in Brooklyn. And I said to Peter, I said, I thought old Creflo was out of Atlanta. What's he doing up here in Brooklyn? He said, well, he is out of Atlanta. He preaches in the morning in Atlanta. Then he gets on a private jet in the afternoon and he flies to New York and he preaches the service and then he flies back that evening. I was like, man, I got the wrong gig at Covenant, man. This place, like Creflo's got a private jet. I got an old Honda. I mean, you laugh. Joke's on you. You're following the wrong preacher. You know, Creflo's flying around in private jets, and, you know, that's an interesting thing to do. And we go back a couple years later, and we're in church. It was kind of quiet upstairs, and I said, Peter, I don't hear anything upstairs. What's going on? He said, well, Creflo's not there anymore. I said, what happened? Did he go out of business? He said, oh no. The neighborhood just gentrified, and so he had to move to a poorer community in Brooklyn. And I said, why would he do that? Isn't he about those dollar bills? And Peter looks at me, he goes, Alec, really? You need me to explain this to you? I said, yeah, I don't get it. No, the prosperity gospel works best with the most poor. I mean, and then that's kind of what it is, right? I mean, here he is flying around in private jets and preying on the poor of our country and telling them that, you know, that the purpose and the outcome of knowing God is that you'll be rich. And of course, we're smart, affluent people. Lots of degrees in this room. We wouldn't believe such things, would we? That's silliness. So if I remember being in Baton Rouge, a congregation similar affluence to this one, and I remember eventually they got me to cheer for LSU, not because I like LSU. Let me make that clear, not because I like LSU. But because when it was a night game at LSU, if the Tigers won, even if the game was over at midnight and we had a 9 a.m. service, everyone would come to church the next day. Isn't that crazy? And the exact opposite effect was true if they lost. wasn't about how late the game went. It was about whether they won or lost. And they came to church if they won, and they didn't come if they were lost. In part, I surmise, because people were happy, and therefore God was good, and they would engage. I saw this at a deeper level, 2007, 2008. Remember when the economy tanks? And all of a sudden, I see people just kind of sucking back and disengaging with the church. And it was really curious to me, because my thought was always, you know, the kind of Karl Marx criticism of religion, that when things go bad, it would be a crutch for people. But that, no, that's not what they do. When things got bad, God was no good anymore, and so they would pull back. And now things are doing good, and look around. We're all engaging. You know, we're too smart for that, though. It's a strange phenomenon, this prosperity gospel. This idea that God's goodness is tied to my personal circumstances. The rival preachers are saying that Paul's gospel is a hoax because he sits in chains. And I think if you've ever been in a place that's really hard, you'll understand what I'm about to say, that suffering reveals what we really believe about God. Suffering reveals the nature of our gospel, that if you savor and adore and treasure and love the God who has saved you by grace, through faith, through Christ alone, that when suffering comes, it doesn't push you off your mark. It doesn't cause you to go to the really deep places of despair and hopelessness, because suffering can't steal the real prize if the real prize is Jesus Christ himself. The gospel that comes by grace through faith says that God is the treasured outcome of your faith. That what you get by his free mercy is Jesus himself, and he cannot be taken away by failures, by cancer, by divorce, by bankruptcy, by loneliness. But if this thing is some weird religious form, veiled form of a prosperity gospel, if it is, I'll be good and God will give me lots of things, then the truth is, God was never really the prize anyway. The goal in this scheme was always my comfort, my pleasure, my prosperity. And suffering will rob you of those things every single time. You know, we got news this week of a friend of ours who's probably the wealthiest man I've ever known. And he died of cancer at 70, which I consider a young age. I've been told by those who are 70, that's a young age. This guy had all the money in the world. He had all the trips to Boston and Houston and every sort of clinical trial and doctor, and everything was at his disposal. And there he lay 6 feet under today. Your money can't protect you from cancer. It can't insulate you from pain. It can't shield you from divorce. It just leaves you angry and depressed and hopeless. And then what we see, we turn to the scriptures, we see Paul in Philippians, who, I mean, sometimes when religious people, we think that all religious people are just dumb, broken, weird. That's not the case of the Apostle Paul. You're going to read a little later on that he was wealthy, that he had status, that he was educated in an elite manner, that people revered him. He had everything that was the epitome of his cultural value. And he gives it all away, and now he sits in chains in Rome. Here he is, Even now that he's been shipwrecked and beaten, and his church plants, which he's given his life to, are being led astray by rival preachers who say that Paul's gospel is nothing. He's lost everything. Even the work of his hands is being challenged. And the text says in verse 18, and Paul rejoices. And Paul rejoices. His suffering produces joy. Why? Because his chains have served the Lord. Look at what he says in verse 12. I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has served to advance the gospel. What he says is that while I was in prison, the imperial guards have come to know the saving grace of Jesus Christ, that the soldiers of my enemies have received the good news of the Lord of the heaven and earth, who's come down to save them. He says, and even more, the advancement has come because, he says in verse 14, his imprisonment is making other preachers bold to speak without fear. Can you hear it? Can you hear the prize of Paul's soul? It's not the false prize of Crefro Dollar's preaching when he swoops in on his private jet to steal from the poor. It's not the false prize of one who loves God when things are good and hates God when things are bad. Prosperity is not Paul's prize, his treasure. No, his treasure is God himself. Such that his suffering and his chains and freedom, he can suffer in his chains and he can rejoice in his freedom because in it Christ has been exalted. And don't misunderstand this. This is not one of those religious things where it's like, okay, give up all the things of the world and like nothing and have no hope and just go numb and feel nothing. No, that's what religion does. Religion says, give up worldly things and replace it with nothing. That's not what Paul is doing here. The gospel says, give up the things of the world and take up something more precious. Because if God is the true reward of our faith in Jesus Christ, then our suffering, it will not be a sentence to despair and hopelessness. It'll be an opportunity of joy, even more a chance to exalt God in a very unlikely situation. Now here's the problem with me. Here's the problem in general. Suffering with Christ is joyful, but it's also really hard. And that's the problem I have is, I don't like to be uncomfortable. I like to run for my comfort devices at any time anything barely hurts. I went to this church of another denomination recently, and I was they had asked me to come and speak on behalf of the EPC. I've done this a couple times. And so I go in there, and normally what happens is I go in and I just kind of, it's like an informational session, and it's question and answer, and we sort of talk about what the EPC is, and, you know, typically there's some divide in the church about whether this is a good idea or not, but in this case there was a deep theological divide about where to go. And I really didn't know this, but I was walking into a hornet's nest. And they were ready to make me the kind of, you know, focal point of their vitriol for everything that whatever I stood against. So I go in there and, you know, I'm thinking la-di-da, they'll ask questions and I'll kind of say what the things are, what we believe and what the facts are. And it turns into this 2-hour smack aleck around fest. And I'm talking, it was bad. It was bad. Like, they would get to the mic. There was no questions being asked. They just stood up there and they were like, you're a bigot. Nice to meet you. I don't know. You know, you're a racist. You're a homophobe. You hate Hispanics. I don't know where they got that one, but they pulled that one out. You know where they got that. That's the political argument that's going on, right? Said, I hate divorced people. You know, it's just like, I can't even name all the ridiculous, like just on and on and on. Meanwhile, none of this stuff was even in discussion, right? I mean, this is not even what we're talking about. Just smacking me around. And you know, you all have known me a little bit. Like, I mean, I think I'm a pretty nice guy most of the time. Like, I have like a pretty wide mark of patience for idiocy. But there kind of comes that moment, you know? There kind of comes that moment. And like when the switch flips, like it goes fast. Maybe you're like this or know somebody like this. And I'm like, you know, I had enough of this. Like, I'm about to let this go. And so I'm getting ready to speak. And it's just, you know, and the Spirit in His graciousness is like, you need to hold your tongue, Bubba. Like, you know, this is not about you. You're representing something much bigger than you. You need to just say thank you very much and be kind and just take it and move on. This is not something I like to do. And so we leave the room, and I'm saying, I'm sweating, man. My blood pressure is up. I'm hot. And I was there with this other friend of mine, pastor, and we get in the car, and he looks at me, and he says, I need a drink. And I said, me too. So we stopped by the shoddiest gas station in Mississippi, you know, and we're driving home with drink. It was not a proud moment, but you know what happens is like, it's like if I feel the slightest sting, something is just a little bit off. I run for all my comfort devices. I run for my numbing agents. Give me my little six-pack Baba and let me push it away so I don't have to feel the pain of it. It's pretty indicative of my life. If suffering comes, I push it away. And what happens is the gospel doesn't advance. I convince myself that the gospel will advance because of my success. But at every turn, what the scriptures say is His power is made perfect in my weakness. That if you read the Bible at all, what you're going to see is that it is always the suffering which is the advance. I mean, this is the Apostle Paul, right? His greatest ministry happens when he's in prison. This is Jesus. There's a cross above my head for a reason. Not because He ruled like Caesar, but because He died like a common criminal. And now there have been billions of people who have come to believe in His name. But my life is oriented around making me comfortable at all ends. And what Paul is saying is, this is wrong-headed. This is the way the world thinks. He's saying that my suffering has advanced the gospel of Christ, that suffering is not pointless, that it is not in every case something to be flinched at or turned from. It is not something to try to pay to get away from, but something to lean into and find Christ in. You know, our dearest Renaud, some of you here know Renaud Hallett, who's a dear member of ours. Man, it's been years of one thing after another. You know, and that's what's crazy about it. It's like, it's not just like, hey, it's cancer, and then it's cancer again, and then it's, you know, the same kind of thing. It's like this, and then it's that, and then it's this, and then it's that, you know. And I've watched Renaud over the years, and I've watched her closely. And I've seen how she looks at this and how she deals with it. And she doesn't hide or dismiss her pain. That's what a lot of people do when somebody like me comes to visit. You know, somebody comes in, it's like, oh, it's no big deal. You know, I'm dying of cancer, whatever. We'll get through it, you know, no big deal. Because there's a sense, especially as Southerners, is that projects strength. You're dying of this out of control disease, but you got it all together. It's no big deal. That's not what Renaud does. She doesn't hide it. She doesn't dismiss it. Renaud stares it in the face, and then she grabs Christ in the middle of it. If you've been with her at any point in time, you know this isn't preacher exaggeration we're doing here. This is what she's been living for years. And the result of it is unusual and unexpected joy. Deep pools of joy that have come out of her communion with Christ in the middle of constant suffering, that what she has done is used her suffering as an occasion to go deeper with Christ, that she has refused lesser hopes. I walk into a lot of hospital rooms, and you know what people do? Their hope is in the next clinical trial. The next sort of expertise of a doctor. Not Renaud. No. She's not hoping in the next procedure. She's not even thinking, you know, saying, will God heal her? What she is doing is she is grabbing a hold of Christ in her suffering and not letting go. And it's a deep and a real and appropriate thing. And I know that because I've watched her struggle. I've watched her in moments of hopelessness. I've seen her in moments of anger. And that's how you know it's real, right? You know someone's not faking it. But even in that, what she does, she grabs Christ, and you can see he is her treasure. Not even getting better. And she says to me, she says, every time I go to see her, she's like, look, I just want to get better, and I want to come back to serving at Crichton Table. You know, because her vision is that she's going to advance the gospel by her ministry to the poor. And I'm like, oh, Renaud, no. You're advancing the gospel through your suffering. If not to many, then just to me. To actually see what it is to watch somebody stare pain in the face over and over and over again and grab hold of Christ and watch pools of joy arise. Of course, I do the opposite. In part because I'm so affluent. I mean, I'm not Creflo, but I got enough money to make things sort of not hurt for a while. And what I do when that happens is I miss the occasion of letting Christ be the true prize of my soul. I miss the opportunity to let God be my satisfaction. You know, I think about that day, and I'm not saying this in a weird religious way. I'm like, you know, what if we hadn't stopped by that old gas station to get a drink? What if two pastors who should know better had used it as an occasion to grab hold of Jesus, to say, you know, Jesus, you were scourged and defamed for my name. I think I could take 2 hours of such things for yours. What a difference it would have been to have gone there with Christ instead of to numb out at a gas station. I think what Paul is saying here is, and this is good news, that if you are in Christ, you do not have to run from your suffering. There is a greater goal and a more precious treasure than your prosperity. There is a sweeter comfort and a better succor than your numbing agents. He is Jesus. And if you will grab hold of your soul's satisfaction in the midst of your suffering, joy will arise. A joy that cannot be stolen by CT scans or the number of zeros in your bank statements. It is a joy that is based on the unchanging character of the God of heaven and earth. And I think if we're going to be a people that looks like that, there will be an advancement of the gospel. Because you're crazy if you think the world isn't out there looking for a treasure better than the things that they can make, produce, touch, or feel. They want something sweeter, but it's only going to come not in the success, but in the suffering, in the advancement of the gospel before their very eyes. But to do that, okay, pleasure hounds, to do that might take a different vision of how we live our life. It might be that our comfort is not our greatest good at all times. It might take the sort of discipline of being maybe what you would call a suburban ascetic. You know what an ascetic is? I can't ever say that word well. You know what I mean by that? It's a person who, it's like a Christian monk. You know, these people would go out and they would give up all the things of the world, and they wear these like hair coats that prick their bodies, constantly giving them pain. And, you know, they drink water and eat soup all day and just pray. But the idea is similar to the one we're talking about. It was that they would give these things up in order to make Christ their satisfaction. Now, look, I'm not sure it's biblical to move to a desert in Utah, and I'm not suggesting that. But what I am suggesting that maybe there's a call to live a little bit more of a suburban ascetic life. That is, one who doesn't run for false comforts just because they can afford them or it's convenient. That there might have to be this intentional denying of ourselves in order to figure out what it means to really take Christ up. And I think if we did that, I think the same would be true for us as it is for Paul here, that there would be streams of joy flowing out of suffering, and there would be an advancement of the gospel. Look, I got a call from that pastor a couple days after we had been there and taken that beating, and I was like, you know, man, I'm sorry. I did not do real well with that. That did not go the way I thought. He said, Alec, it was perfect. I was like, were you there? Did you see what happened? It's a disaster. He's nah, man. He's like, they hung themselves. You know, I mean, they welcome a guest in and then they bear some. First of all, that's against social norms in Mississippi, if I ever know one. But more than that, I mean, it was pretty clear, he says to the quiet majority, what side the Spirit of Christ and the fruits of the Spirit were on. And it was an encouragement to me, not because I did anything right, but because I think, you know, sometimes that the Lord himself can take the scraps of my suffering and use them for a progress in the gospel. May it be so for you. Let's pray.